Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Warden's Watch, Episode 106, For the Fallen. And on this episode, during Police Week, Warden's Watch has highlighted game wardens, conservation officers, wildlife officers that have died in the line of duty. And this time, we are highlighting David Grove, wildlife conservation officer for the state of Pennsylvania. We talked to Tom Gruhl, who is the most senior wildlife commission officer on scene that night. David was shot by an illegal night hunter who was also a felon in possession of a firearm that shouldn't have had one. Reminds me of the Kevin Bear story where Kevin was shot again by another felon in possession of a firearm, again, that shouldn't have had one. I'd like to read a few things going into this podcast. I went to the officer down site, and there was a few things that touched me. I was going to just read one, but I had two that kind of touched my heart. So as an officer, for sure. I was proud to be a part of the caravan for the Pennsylvania Game Commission officers and Pennsylvania State Police troopers that escorted Officer Grove's body from Lehigh Valley Hospital to the Gift of Life Foundation in Philadelphia. In the spirit of a true American hero, Officer Grove was an organ donor and tissue donor. His final gift will enable many others to heal, and he will live on in the bodies of many grateful people. Thank you, Pennsylvania State Police, for your support and your top-notch investigation and speedy arrest of the suspect and your escort to Philly and then to the home to Adams County. The real irony in his passing is that he wrote an article for the Pennsylvania Game News, our agency's magazine, entitled A Shot in the Dark, about an investigation into a nighttime poaching incident. It was published in the November issue. My deepest condolences to Officer Grove's family. He has been in my thoughts since I got the dreaded phone call Friday morning. Please know that he died doing something that in our unique band of law enforcement professionals is passionate about, being a guardian for the wild creatures, wilderness, and the people that are sworn by duty to protect. Rest in peace, brother. I know you'll be watching over us out in the woods and on those dark, lonely back roads forever. Lieutenant Bertone, Whitehall Police, and Deputy Wildlife Conservation Officer, Pennsylvania Game Commission, November 16th, 2010. And that is on the Officer Down or the Officer Memorial page. Thank you, Lieutenant, for those words, and thank you for your service as well. I think he touches a lot of things that, as a game warden, he's right. We love what we do, and we love where we do it. And David was a great example of that protector that gave the ultimate sacrifice. The other one that really touched me, and this is the one I was just going to read, but as a game warden, Lieutenant Bertone's words touched me. And this touched me, and if you've listened to the Warden's Watch podcast on Memorial Week before, we had the honor of interviewing Justin Hurst's parents. Justin was a Texas game warden who was killed in the line of duty, gunned down, and Alan and Pat, mostly Alan, but Pat certainly, I could hear her in the background talking, and you can on the podcast, and bless your heart, Pat, I really appreciate that. Two parents that, you know, lost a child, but give back so much, as they can, to make his sacrifice not go in vain. And I'll read, as the parents of a fellow game warden who's killed by a poacher, our hearts go out to your family as another senseless killing has taken one of the best from our law enforcement family. There will always remain that giant hole in your heart that only those who have lost a child can seem to understand. Look to those around you, as well as your law enforcement family, in your time of grief. We are here for you. God be with you in this time of need. Pat and Alan Hurst, parents of Texas Game Warden Justin Hurst. End of watch, 3/17/07. So, and if you'd like to go back in the Warden's Watch archives, that interview is there. And this week I will put it out on my social media too, recapping the past podcasts we've done for Memorial, the Law Enforcement Memorial Week. So thank you for everybody that contributes to this week, as it's so important that we never forget. Thank you. Warden's Watch, episode 106. And this episode is our memorial episode. And this year we have gone to Pennsylvania to talk about wildlife conservation officer David Grove. And here to talk about David is, you retired, I believe, as a deputy chief, Tom Gruhl?
I retired as deputy executive director.
Okay. that's a little up from deputy chief. So, but really, thank you for your service, Tom, and thank you for joining us. And
thank you. It's a pleasure.
And tough subjects too, for sure. I mean, every year I do this officer memorial podcast because I never want to forget, but I think you said it best. It's, you know, we don't want to forget, but it's difficult to remember. And David, I've been doing my research here, and he seems like the game warden's game warden. He sounds like that was probably his life goal, was to be a game warden.
He was, you know, and I'll be the first to admit, I didn't know David very well. I did some instruction at our training academy when David was a cadet, so I knew him from there. He was then assigned to the South Central Region in Adams County. And I did, actually, the last time I saw him, he was playing in the Game Commission holds an annual golf tournament. Mm-hmm. And he had a team and played in the golf tournament, and he was a lot of fun. So it's maybe sad to say, but I feel like I know David much better now after his untimely death than I did when he was working for me.
Mm. Because this has become pretty personal to you, too, as you had to deal with this incident, pretty much, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, the chain of events that led to both David's murder and my involvement are somewhat unusual. At the time, I was working as the assistant director of our Bureau of Law Enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I was at the time supervising our undercover unit. It was my primary responsibility, but I was also the emergency management liaison for the Game Commission to the state, the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. So that's why I was the first person to be contacted when David was discovered that he was shot that night. They had called me at home probably within minutes of it occurring. And it was kind of unusual. So I was accustomed to getting phone calls from Pima at night. In fact, at the time, there was a little joke in my family that, you know, my kids would answer the phone and they'd say, "Dad, it's Pima again." And it would be some really unimportant call, and I'd make a call to an officer or a region and they'd handle it. But this night, it was very much different. I got the call. It was about, it was probably 11 p.m. It was on Veterans Day, the holiday, November 11th. So everybody was off. It was a state holiday. And I was actually in bed. I had just come home from hunting in Maine, and with a bunch of other Pennsylvania game wardens, and we had met up with the Maine wardens, and we were eider hunting up in Maine. And I wasn't even supposed to be home that night, but the weather turned terrible, and we decided to come home a day early. So I had just driven home from Maine, and at 11 o'clock, I was in bed when the phone rang. And my son answered the phone, and he said, "Dad, it's Pima." And again, I just expected, you know, it was going to be some deer issue or some other, you know, really unimportant wildlife-related issue that they needed a hand with. And when I picked up the phone, immediately I could sense that this was not going to be just an ordinary call. And the person on the other end said, "This is so-and-so." I don't even remember his name, from the emergency management agency. And he said, "We're to inform you that there's been an officer involved shooting with one of your officers, and he was killed." Now you can imagine what happens. My head is like spinning. And I'm thinking about all these things. And the first question that came to my mind naturally was, "Who is it?" And so I asked him, and I said, "Well, can you tell me who it was?" And he wouldn't tell me. I don't know if he didn't know. But he would not tell me who it was. He would just tell me where it happened. And he gave me the address on Shriver Road in Adams County, just outside of Gettysburg. And he said, "We need you to respond to the scene immediately." Well, I was an hour away. And like I said earlier, I was supervising our undercover unit, and I was working a case. And so I had a beard, and I didn't really, you know, look like an officer. So I just threw some clothes on. I got in my car and I started driving to the office, which was on my way to the scene. And I started making phone calls. The first person I called was my supervisor at the time, who was our director of law enforcement, Rich Palmer. He was away at a hunting camp and had no cell service, so I didn't get a hold of him. And then I called our executive director. Well, he was away as well. I couldn't get him. So it was kind of on me. So I called Jason Dukotsky, who today is our director of law enforcement. He was the only guy I could get, and he had already knew. Because as you know, in a small agency, when something like this happens, even though it was a state holiday, word spread like wildfire. So we made arrangements to meet at headquarters, and he was going to get in my car, and we drove to Gettysburg from there. On the way to Gettysburg, which was, like I said, about an hour, I got a call from the Adams County Coroner's Office, and they said that they needed someone to go notify David's family because the suspect was still at large. They had a license plate number that David had called in before he was shot and a description of the vehicle. And they wanted to put it out on all the news stations, and they were afraid that David's family would hear this and put two and two together and find out what happened without being formally notified. So we're driving down, they called, and so now I have a decision to make because I'm supposed to go to the scene. I also need someone to go to David's parents' house and notify them. So at the time, I was also the manager of our critical incident peer contact team. The interesting part was we also had officers who were out working that night. Dispatch was closed because at that time, when it was a state holiday, our dispatch offices didn't work. Now that we've changed that since. But we had officers responding to the scene because they had heard about it, and we had no radio communications with the state police, and they were the investigating agency. So it was kind of a very chaotic. You know, officers are driving to the scene because they know that the suspect's still at large. They want to help find him. I need somebody to go to talk to David's parents and notify them. And I had never met them. I didn't know where they lived. So eventually I wound up talking to another officer who was a friend of David's. And we decided that we would meet and he would take me over to David's parents' house, and I was going to do the notification to them. We knocked on David's parents' door at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And you can imagine when you have there were three of us that knocked on their door that night. They later had told me that when they saw us pull up in the marked vehicle, that they thought it was David coming, because I guess it was not unusual for David to stop by at all hours of the night. He was very close with his family. They're a very tight-knit family, and he would go in there and tell them about some of his experiences on the job, and they really were very interested in what he did and very supportive of him. It was a very tight-knit family, and they had later told me that they thought it was David when we pulled into the driveway. We knocked on the door at 3 a.m. and unfortunately had to deliver that terrible news to them that what happened. Mm. And then, you know, you can imagine, you know, how difficult that was.
No, absolutely. That's something that parents never, ever, ever want to hear. They'd almost know it when they answer the door and see you standing there at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. You know, it's not good.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. So from that point, did you respond to the scene?
I had actually went to the scene before I went to David's parents' house. Okay. When I got to the scene, I was the first game commission officer to arrive on scene. When I got there, PSP, Pennsylvania State Police, had just their evidence processing unit had just arrived on scene. They were setting up big spotlights. When I got there, David's car was parked on Shriver Road, which it was kind of rural, but it was a road where there were some very kind of big houses with big properties, and they were spread apart pretty far. And it was just outside Gettysburg National Battlefield. So I pulled up, and the sergeant there, state police, said, "Do you want me to walk you through the scene?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." So he did. It was kind of unnerving, because when I walked, his car was shut off, but the lights were still on. His gun was laying on the ground next to an open door. His glasses were laying there on the ground. There were bullet holes all through the car. Shell casings. There were, in this particular incident, David fired 16 rounds, and his assailant, I believe, fired 12 rounds, something like that. There were over 25 rounds exchanged between the two of them, which that's a lot of rounds in a police shooting. But, you know, it was kind of surreal when you walk through that scene. So I did do that. Just quickly then I asked Jason Dukoski to remain at the scene. And then by that time, Travis Pugh, who also worked in our bureau, showed up. And the two of them were going to coordinate as our officers were responding. They were going to try and coordinate them into making sure it didn't conflict with what the state police were doing at the time, because the state police investigators had arrived, and they were trying to ping the suspect. They knew who he was because David did everything right on his vehicle stop. He called it in. He ran the plate. He said they were armed. He said he was doing a felony vehicle stop. Unfortunately, at one time, the last transmission David said to county radio was that he was going to wait in his vehicle for backup to arrive before he approached the vehicle. We'll never know exactly why that didn't happen, because backup arrives after two, I believe, if I'm trying to remember this, but I'm pretty sure I'm pretty accurate here, 2 minutes and 35 seconds after his last transmission, backup, a local township PD, arrived on scene to find David laying in behind his vehicle dead. And as you know, Wayne, for a conservation officer, for backup to be available within 2 minutes and 35 seconds, that really is unusual, because for where we work and how we work, to have backup that close and that available. But we'll never really know why that he changed his mind and decided to approach the suspects before backup arrived.
Yeah. Can you walk us through what happened?
So we had to kind of piece this together. The state police did an excellent job. They were, I can't say enough about, you know, their investigation and how they kept us apprised and kept us part of the whole incident as it progressed. But here's what happened. There were two people in the vehicle that night, the suspect's vehicle. They had been hunting at a local camp that one of their relatives owned. They were drinking. Christopher Johnson, he was a convicted felon, not to possess firearms. He had a long history of problems with the law. And him and his other friend, who was a little younger than him, spent the entire day hunting and drinking while they were hunting. They were both intoxicated, I'm sure. They decided they didn't see anything while hunting. They were going to go out and poach some deer. So David had some suspicions about some poaching that had been going on in the Gettysburg National Battlefield. So that night, even though it was a holiday, he used some pre-approved overtime that he had to go out and work. And he was by himself. So he was parked probably within a mile of where they poached a deer that night, and he heard the shot. When he heard the shot, he radioed in to county radio. Like I said, Game Commission dispatch was closed, so he only had access to county radio, but it was great communications. He had Adams County control. So he radios in that he's working his location. He heard a shot. He sees a spotlight working, and he's going to proceed into that area. When he gets there, he finds them. It wasn't hard. He got on them right away. He attempts to do a vehicle stop, and he's radios in that they're not stopping, but they're not really trying to elude him. They're not, you know, it's not a high speed chase. They're just going normal speed, but they're not stopping. And after about 2 minutes, he radios in that they've stopped on Shriver Road in kind of a desolate. It's not real remote. There are houses within maybe a couple of hundred yards, but it's a very dark road. There are no streetlights, no sidewalks. It's a very wooded field, farm type lane. And he radios in that he has them stopped. There's two individuals. He calls in the plate and he says there's firearms in the vehicle because he can see them passing a rifle around. And he says he's going to wait for backup until backup arrives. And that's the last we ever hear from David. So here's what we have pieced together from, although they were uncooperative once they were both discovered who they were, here's what we kind of, what the investigation revealed is that for some reason, David had the driver get out of the vehicle. He had him throw the keys out the window, turn the vehicle off, and then he had him exit the vehicle and walk backwards towards David's patrol vehicle in front of the headlights. When he got there, from what we can determine is David was attempting to handcuff him. And when he put the first handcuff on, David felt him pull out a firearm from his front of his waistband and spin around. And this, we've got some of this from the accomplice that night. All he said is he heard David yell, "Don't do it, don't do it." And then there were a number of shots. So kind of forensics and the investigation revealed that there was a huge exchange of gunfire. It started within a foot of each other. And we believe that David was shot one time at that range in his upper thigh. And the suspect was shot twice by David. Now, this guy has, at this night, had to be one of the luckiest persons I've ever known. One shot hit a cell phone in his pocket, and it deflected into his hip and caused very minimal damage, not even enough to knock him down. And that when he was apprehended, they took him to the hospital. They treated it, and he was released within an hour. The other round hit a knife that he had on his belt and completely deflected and didn't do any damage. So then what we surmise happened is when David got shot in the upper thigh is that he fell down and he lost his firearm. And when he got up, he was taking cover to the rear of his vehicle. And at that time, before he got around the rear of the vehicle, he took a round to the back of his neck, and it was a fatal shot.
No, that's horrible. Yeah. So, and then the suspect runs off. So
the suspect runs off, and the suspect, his firearm was a Colt 911, 45 caliber. And we later found out that, you know, he fired at least, I can't remember the exact number, but it was more than one magazine. So we know that he had to reload during that exchange. And that actually was critical for the prosecution because they tried to blame it on David, say he shot first during the trial. But that showed intent. Like when he was reloading, that helped prove that his intent was to kill David because he had fired so many rounds and actually had to reload, you know, to continue shooting at David. So after that, he gets in his truck and they drive away, and the passenger, his name was Lauman. So this guy's panicking and he knows what's happened. And he tells the shooter that I want out off. And so he does. He drops him off about 2 miles down the road. And he has a cell phone. And this guy calls his girlfriend, who lives about 30 minutes away, and says, you got to come get me. She comes and picks him up. He goes home and goes to bed. Doesn't tell anybody. Doesn't call the police. Doesn't tell anybody what happens. He just goes to bed. The suspect, who now is driving away, he's got one cuff on his wrist. And this is how lucky he is. He drives down to a remote gas line about maybe 10 miles away. He gets out and he rests his wrist on a log and he takes his 45 and he shoots the cuff off his wrist. He doesn't get hurt. Like, you and I could not do that without probably blowing our hand off. And he shoots the cuff off, and it comes off. He then says that he runs through the woods, taking the firearms. He had a .22 and the Colt 911. As he's running through the woods, he throws them in the woods. They were never recovered. Here we are, what? 13, going on 13 years later, those firearms have never recovered. And I can't tell you the effort that we put in to try and recover those firearms. We had a cadet class in our Game Warden Academy. We spent days searching. We had canines. We had volunteers. We had PSP. We spent a week trying to recover those firearms, and we unfortunately could never find them. And you would think 13 years later that maybe a hunter would find them,
right,
and recover them. But to my knowledge, they've never been recovered. So anyway, he discards the gun. He comes out on a highway and he starts to hitchhike. Now, by now, the state police know who he is. They have his cell phone and, you know, they're pinging his cell phone. So they know a general description. They know where this camp. Now they've gone to this other person's house. They found out that he was with them, and they go and interview the accomplice. And at first, he doesn't say anything. He's claiming he doesn't know anything. Finally, they get it out of him after several trips, I believe, to his house. And he tells them that they were at this camp. So they suspect the suspect's heading back to the camp. So they get the SWAT team, and they're now at the camp waiting for him to arrive because they think that maybe is where he's going. And he is, and he hits the he got picked up by an elderly gentleman who didn't have any idea who he was or what he had done. And he pulls into the camp, and the SWAT team just take him down. And he gets apprehended without any incident. And he's arrested that day and arraigned. So I
bet that the old buck that picked him up was probably regretting that.
I'm sure. Yeah, actually, it worked out best, though, because who knows? If he didn't get picked up, we might not have been able to get him so quickly.
That's right, but he had a shock sitting there.
I mean, he was on the loose maybe some 11 p.m. till about maybe 11 a.m. the next day, about 12 hours.
Wow. But that's actually pretty good apprehension time frames for fleeing. So
yes, they really did a great job.
They did the tracking of the phone, the planning of going back to the camp. That was really smart to be set up and ready to go there for sure. Yeah, no, they certainly worked hard and worked fast within 12 hours. Having him in custody is certainly proof of that. And then the aftermath. I think some of these interviews, I know I talked about, Justin Hirst, and I had talked to his family, that the trial is probably the most impactful thing for a family. I mean, certainly losing your loved one's probably the most impactful, but, now you have to go through a trial, which...
So I forget the exact time frame. It was over a year, maybe 2 years until he actually went to trial. Mm-hmm. He was charged with capital murder with possibility of death sentence. Because of the publicity, David's murder became a national news event. And I don't know if you recall this, but at his funeral, his parents requested the full, ceremonial type burial. We used a high school gymnasium. There were thousands of people there, game wardens from all over the country. I actually was helping coordinate the funeral detail as well. And one of the most moving things that happened, I do get emotional sometimes.
Yeah. As you should,
was the support that both David's family and the game commission received during the 2 weeks after his death was some of the most inspiring things I've ever experienced. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry.
No. Nope. Totally understand. A police funeral is incredibly moving.
We received, cards and letters and gifts from across. I would get the mail several days after David's death with just bags full of sympathy cards and gifts and mementos from police agencies, wildlife agencies, dispatch centers from all over the country. It was, even though it was probably one of the most horrific things I dealt with in my career, it was, that part of it was like so inspiring, and the people really cared about what happened. So we did the full ceremonial detail for a line of duty death. There were probably, I'm estimating, 1,000 game wardens there. It was really truly a moving experience. And I remember from the high school to where the grave site was about a 5-mile trip. And I remember I was one of the lead cars behind the hearse, and other officers were calling me on my cell phone saying when the hearse was pulling into the gates at the grave site, there still were cars that hadn't, police cars and game warden cars that still had not left the parking lot of the high school where the eulogy was held, because the procession was over 5 miles long. It was really inspiring. There were people standing on the sidewalks in the town. It was they had American flags, and it was really moving. It really was. That was a big deal, and we finally got that taken care of. It was funny because David's parents had wanted a specific pastor to preside over the gravesite ceremony, and he couldn't be there until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So you can imagine what happened when this whole process, you know, it was like a 3-hour service. We were actually in the dark with over 1,000 people at the gravesite. We had to coordinate with lights and parking, and the community came together, and, you know, the ambulance and the fire departments, and it was really a combined effort with so many different agencies to make it a funeral worth showing what David's sacrifice meant.
That's very, very well put. Funerals like this are very touching, and I think most people in the community, you know, are very sensitive to that, and they support their game wardens, their conservation officers, their police officers, their fire and their EMS people and dispatchers. Right. I think that's...
So then the trial, it was funny because there was so much publicity, the defense argued that they could not get a jury of unbiased people out of Adams County. So they made a motion to actually, they wanted to move the entire trial to another county. Well, the judge didn't allow that, but what he did allow was for a jury to be selected from another county and to be brought in to Adams County. With the courthouse was in downtown Gettysburg. So we had the trial. There were probably 20 game wardens, if not more, at the trial every single day, including David's parents. At the time, by the time the trial rolled around, I believe Matt Ho was our executive director at the time, and he came to the trial every day. And he actually, we shuttled David's family back and forth to the courthouse every day. They stayed in a local hotel. The victim, the person who helps victims out of the county courthouse,
the victim witness advocate.
Great. Yeah. Yes, the victim's advocate. You know, she was with them. So there was a lot of support throughout the entire trial. I attended every day of the trial myself, and it took about a week. The great thing was the jury, well, before I get there, the defense tried to put the blame, the shooting, on David. They tried to say that he fired first. Nobody's going to know who fired first. To tell you the truth, if David fired first, he should have got a medal for being the guy who fired first, because the way it went down is, you know, David did extremely well to get any rounds off.
Right.
They tried to portray that the defendant had all these mental health issues, and that his father, you know, mistreated and abused him, and he had all these issues. He was on depression medicine and all these other inconsequential excuses. So after about a week trial, went to jury deliberations, and the great thing was they deliberated 3 hours before finding him guilty on all charges, which that made us feel really good that it was, you know, not, it wasn't a you know, a hung jury, or it wasn't any long deliberations. It took them 3 hours to convict him. So after that, of course, the sentencing hearing took place, and that was that happened. I forget, maybe in a month or two later, and the sentencing hearing, the same thing. It went on for a few days. They called a bunch of witnesses. They challenged our training program a little bit, but after it took them 1 hour. I believe it was 1 hour to sentence him to death. And I remember the when they announced that verdict out of the jury, when they sentenced him to death, a lot of the defendant's family were in the courtroom, and it got a little hairy there for a while after they announced the death penalty, but nothing really happened, but it did get a little tense in the courtroom. But today he's still on death row. I don't suspect, you know, we're almost 13 years later, 12 years later, and he's still in prison. But the good thing is, it's my understanding, when you're sentenced to death, you don't really have a lot of privileges like just a normal inmate have. So I don't think, you know, he's having a great time in prison. So he's paying his dues.
Right. And still has that coming, certainly.
So from there, you know, we started honoring Dave. We created a scholarship in Dave's name through our Officers Association, which we created a scholarship fund at Penn State for any wildlife students. That was fully funded for eternity. We did a lot of fundraising events. We did, 5K runs, memorial runs for years, a lot of different events to raise money in David's name. The landowner where David was killed donated a little chunk of land right where he was shot to the game commission to erect a memorial. So there's a stone there, and it has David's, a plaque with David's photo on it and a little history about what happened that night. And every year, David's family hosts a dinner, in the evening of, November 11th, we all get together and kind of celebrate at a dinner. Then right at the time, I think it's 10:38 when David was actually shot, 10:38 p.m., we go to the memorial site and do a little ceremony. And we've done that every year. And it really helps not only keep his memory alive, but it's very consoling to Dave's family. Throughout this whole event, I've got to know Dave's family very well. I feel like I know Dave very well. Also, we've kept Dave's family as part of our Game Commission family there. They're invited to all our events, as I'm sure every law enforcement agency tries to do that for an officer who's killed in line of duty. But they're still a part of our family, and I'm sure they always will be. And we also try to keep Dave's memory alive by teaching about this incident to our cadets. We make sure that they spend, I did before I retired. I spent an hour in there just going over what we're doing here today. So they know the sacrifice that Dave made and can appreciate that and learn that, you know, as conservation law enforcement officers, sometimes we feel like we don't deal with the same exact dangers as traditional policing, but you know, and I know that that's not true. It can happen. And I think it's important for our people to realize that and that they take their training seriously. Dave did everything right that night. There's nothing in my mind. I've gone over this a lot. There's nothing that David could have done differently, except maybe waited. And we don't know why he didn't wait. Maybe he had no choice. But the only thing that I believe would have saved David's life that night was a partner. If he had another officer there, I don't think that would have went down that way. There might have been a shooting, but I don't think it would have ended that way. Who knows? But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, because we always try to look at lessons learned. And I think the lesson here is to share David's legacy. And it's comforting for officers in the academy to know what happens if there isn't a line of duty death that it occurs to them. It's comforting to know that your family's going to be taken care of and what's happened before. Even though
it was, that night changed our agency. So I was a defensive tactics instructor for years. And I remember when you're teaching handcuffing techniques and different other defensive techniques, we would always say that people are going to realize that you're serious when you put the cuffs on them. They know you're not joking and they're going. And that is exactly what happened here that night. This guy, David, got one cuff on him and he realized he was going to jail. And it wasn't about the poaching. It wasn't about the alcohol. It was about he was a convicted felon. He was on probation and he knew he was going back to jail. Mm. And that's why he did what he did that night is because, and you know, you just, as a law enforcement officer, you don't know what's going on in this person's life or in their mind. And that's what you have to prepare for every day is because you don't know what's going to happen. And I remember as a defensive tactics instructor telling people that, you know, we've been very fortunate in the Pennsylvania Game Commission where we haven't had an officer killed in the line of duty, at least feloniously, maybe 100 years. And I always said how lucky we were. And then you never know when it's going to happen. That's the thing about this. There's no way of telling, you know, when these incidents happen and you have to be prepared. That's what I teach for a while after this incident happened is you can't wait until an incident like this happens to be prepared. And I think today most agencies are prepared. You have to know what you're going to do and how you're going to handle it before it happens. And that's critical for wildlife agencies and any law enforcement agency. You have to be prepared for these things.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Tom Grohall, retired Assistant Executive Director, Pennsylvania Commission, talking about the ultimate sacrifice wildlife officer David Grove gave on Thursday, November 11th, 2010. Thank you for your service, David, to the wildlife and the people of Pennsylvania and the United States.
once in a while, it's fun to go like just full-blown redneck on these fish. This is like high-tech cane pole fishing right here.
From the white sandy beaches to the crystal blue waters, enjoy the best fishing Panama City Beach has to offer during Chasing the Sun. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.